listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we update news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
From my point of view and from a regional point of view, I'm sure the status of Ignacio Lula da Silva as the presidential candidate for the Brazilian Workers' Party is of fundamental importance for what happens in the region over the next few years.
For sure.
And that's still not clear.
Yeah.
He's been registered as a presidential candidate in the electoral system. The judicial system continues to reject every attempt by his defense lawyers to get a habeas corpus based on the numerous irregularities that took place in the course of his trial and sentencing. He's got, in case people don't know, Lula has been sentenced to 12 years in jail for a non-existent a corruption offense that he's accused of, based on zero evidence except a really marginal confession by somebody who made that confession in exchange for a lesser sentence for the crime that he was guilty of.
Right.
And that is the entire basis of the case against Lula.
Yeah, this seems to be a weapon of choice lately for political hits, because it's exactly the same thing they're doing with Trump. With him, they're basically arresting everybody that ever met him and charging them with everything and saying, but, you know, we can go easy on you if you just tell us what he did.
Right. And exactly that same modus operandi is being used against Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the former president of Argentina.
That's right.
And that's, you know, in a way, and although the case of Lula da Silva is far more important in regional terms because he's actually a presidential candidate in Brazil's forthcoming elections in October, the first week of October.
And he'll likely win if he's allowed to run, by the way.
He's streets ahead in the polls. And he is by far the most popular candidate among all the presidential candidates registered for that election.
All of them, period. He's the most popular politician in Brazil, and perhaps in Brazil's recent history.
Oh, absolutely. And there's no question about that. And that's absolutely beyond dispute. And that is, of course, why he's in jail.
Exactly why he's in jail. You're right. Yep.
Because the Brazilian elites will not tolerate a victory by Lula da Silva and a return to a government that actually works on behalf of Brazil's impoverished majority.
Right. They can't get him out any other way. So this is what they're doing.
Yeah, and so there are all kinds of wrinkles to the current situation. For example, the Brazilian media, led by O Globo, in effect Brazil's media monopoly, the big corporate giant, very similar to the corporate giants that monopolize media in the United States. The Brazilian media are boycotting Lula da Silva, not allowing him to take part in the presidential debates, which are a long tradition in Brazil's electoral process. And so for the most popular candidate in Brazil's electoral campaign to be excluded from the electoral debates that are televised throughout the country is a gross abuse of corporate monopoly media power, very similar to the abuse of power by Brazil's judiciary. So what you have there is a classic example of the way in which, and I remember having a conversation once with one of the leading Sandinista strategists here, a guy called Orlando Nunez Soto. And he said years ago in this conversation, one of the fundamental things that we had to make sure of during the process of recovering power before Daniel Ortega was ever re-elected back in 2006, in the election of 2006, but for a decade or more before that, the Sandinista Party here made sure that it trained up a generation of lawyers that then took part in the judicial system.
Right.
And that's what has enabled them to prevent the judicial system here in Nicaragua being abused in the same way that the judicial system has been abused in Brazil and Argentina and Ecuador.
That's
a very important lesson for any progressive movement in the rest of Latin America or anywhere else in the world.
And not only that, almost like an exclamation point on the sentence that you just spoke. You know, their frustration is best symbolized by the smashing of a helicopter against the Supreme Court in Venezuela, where they were not able to use the court system to assassinate the government, as they've done in Brazil and Argentina and elsewhere.
Right. So then, in Argentina, what's happened over the last week or so is that the Argentinian Senate authorized the judicial authority to carry out what they call allanamientos. I've forgotten what the phrase is in English for when the police and the judicial authorities go to a property, somebody's house, and search it. And a search warrant, is that the phrase in English?
Yeah.
And the Argentinian Senate issued a authority to the judicial power to allow a search warrant for, I think it was a total of three properties owned by Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And having gone to all that trouble of doing due process to get that search warrant, they then completely violated the terms of the search warrant by refusing to allow Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner's lawyer to be present during the searches. So, you know, who knows what they may have planted.
Right.
You know?
Right, exactly.
And the apparent result of those three searches was zero, as to be expected. But I don't think that the judicial authority was interested in what they may or may not have found, because they know as well as anybody with half a brain in Argentina knows that Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is not somebody who's been involved in corruption. Although some of her ministers may have abused her administration, and the previous administration of Nestor Kirchner may have abused their power, she personally is kind of squeaky clean. So the Argentinian authorities weren't expecting to find anything. What the whole object of the exercise was to time the searches at peak hour media viewing, at peak hour TV viewing. So that everybody in Argentina watching the mainstream news would have seen the headlines of the police and the judicial authority searching Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner's properties and houses. So, and of course, with the object of framing her, putting her in a frame as somebody likely to be guilty of corruption, which is exactly what they did in the case of Ignacio Lula da Silva in Brazil.
Right.
And it's exactly what they did in the case of former Vice President Jorge Glass in Ecuador and former President, and what they're doing currently to former President, the former President of Ecuador, Rafael Correa.
Right.
So, and that's, what you have across the region is a right-wing power, the kind of de facto power, the poder factico is what they call it here in Latin America, unable to make gains electorally except by means of deceit, as Mauricio Macri did. And the interesting thing about the situation in Argentina is that there's been a parade of senior business people through the judicial process in Argentina. And what happens is, If they repent and take up that ancient historical Latin American Spanish figure of the arrepentido, the person that saves themselves from the tortures of the Inquisition by repenting.
Right.
If they take up that status, then they go free. And so none of the investigation has touched anybody in Mauricio Macri's business empire, and they're up to their eyes in corruption. Mm. And the very investigation that set in play against Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner paradoxically has actually turned up more likelihood and more evidence of involvement by right-wing business figures, for example, like the leadership of Argentina's biggest company, Techint. Closely associated with the Macri regime, but they walk free, right? And right. So the only people that get detained are people that refuse to repent because they've got nothing to repent about.
Oh, yeah, of course, no. It's like what they did with the witches in Salem. You know,
right.
You throw them in the river. If they drown, they were innocent. You know? So it's interesting, the UN Human Rights Committee... the Human Rights Commission, excuse me. You've got to, like, juggle all these different committees and commissions there. The UN Human Rights Commission, I think it was last week, issued a finding that Lula should be allowed to run in Brazil. And
yeah.
Sarah Cleveland, who's the vice president of the commission, and an American, she's a law professor at Columbia here in New York, she issued a statement... when was this? Because it's at the Telesur's website today. So within the last couple of days, she said the precautionary measures issued, this is the statement that was issued by the commission, are not recommendations. They are legally binding and impose an international legal obligation on Brazil to fulfill them.
Yeah, no, and I was going to mention that because... And what the Brazilian authorities are saying is that while they recognize and take note of the UN Commission for Human Rights document or statement, they don't regard it as binding. And then, and that, but that was before what Sarah Cleveland said. So, and let's see. And I don't think that they're going to pay any attention to that, because it's too important for them to keep Lula out of the presidential race. So they'll ignore that.
Right.
And in any case, what's likely to happen is that between now and the end of probably mid-September, or towards the end of September, there'll be a judgment either from the Supreme Electoral Authority in Brazil or from the Supreme Justice Tribunal in Brazil, the Supreme Right. Court in Brazil, saying that Lula isn't entitled to run because he's in jail.
Right.
And that'll, you know, that is going to be the end of it. It's extremely unlikely. I can't think of any circumstances in which it's likely that Lula da Silva will be allowed to run in the Brazilian presidential election. I might be wrong. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see it.
And they're holding it, you know, off as late as possible, so that if PT is going to have another candidate, that they get as little benefit of campaign season as possible. And, you know,
yeah.
So you mentioned a Globo before. Like today, their headline, 13 deaths of politicians in the 2016 election, only three were resolved. This is just in the state of Rio. The next item down, they're accusing the PT of irregular advertising on Twitter.
Right.
Like, just, you know, there's like an ongoing... well, they call it lawfare in Telesur today, but it's like this ongoing campaign in the corporate media there to keep the Socialist Party, the Workers' Party, out of power. That's essentially what it is.
Yeah, no, I know, it's not just lawfare. I know the corrupt role of the judiciary, and that's where the true corruption lies. It's a moral corruption,
mm-hmm.
not a financial corruption. Although you can bet your bottom dollar that there's big money involved paying off the judges to play ball, right?
Right.
But and the fundamental thing is it's the marriage of, and we've talked about this in the past. It is fascism.
Yes,
it is. It's marriage of corporate power with political power.
And not just look, the first thing I mentioned was, oh, by the way, 13 dead politicians just in the state of Rio in the 2016 election. There's also the terror campaign that accompanies that. And I'm assuming when they're not counting deaths, that there's a lot of, like, you know, behinds being whooped as well in, you know, the typical brown shirt style.
Right. And that political reality prevails across the region, because, for example, another big event over the last few days has been the referendum on corruption in Colombia.
Right.
And sometime last year, the Green Party and associated politicians instigated a request for a referendum on the issue of corruption in Colombia. And of course, the people who are most opposed to that were Alvaro Uribe and his team.
Right.
The former narco-terror president of Colombia, Alvaro Uribe. So anyway, they managed to push through the referendum on corruption in Colombia. And of course, a massive majority of people voted for the measures proposed in the referendum that would seek to limit the possibilities for corruption in Colombia. But technically, for the measure to become binding on the Colombian legislature and the Colombian executive, they fell short by about a million votes. So it's not clear at all what's going to happen about the result of that referendum on corruption in Colombia. But the fundamental thing there is that in Colombia, what you've got is a government that is very, or a, not so much a government as a whole political system dominated by the Colombian elites, that is geared to serving the interests of United States foreign policy in South America. not just South America, in the whole region, because Colombia is also a country that has a Caribbean coast and impinges upon territorial matters in Central America as well.
Right. Yep.
But and the fundamental thing there is that the United States is able to use the Colombian government. For example, why did the United States allow the peace process, the peace negotiations between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrilla that fought a civil war in Colombia for well over 50 years? Why did the United States allow that peace process when they've invested billions of dollars in militarily defeating the FARC? Well, the reason they did that was to remove that the possibility that the FARC would tie up tens of thousands of Colombian troops in the event of some kind of military intervention in Venezuela. And so so what you've got there is why are the Colombian elites allowing this process, this referendum process against corruption? Because the whole impulse of Colombian politics over the last few years has been to restructure itself in a way that makes it acceptable to, in particular, to United States opinion, but to international opinion in general, so that they can better fulfill the foreign policy requirements of the United States government.
Right.
And you can see that especially in relation to Venezuela. And you can also see the relation of how the European Union is engaged by the fact that the new Spanish Prime Minister, I've even forgotten his name, has just started a tour of South America, starting in Chile very significantly, because, you know, and for people familiar with Latin American and Spanish history, and the Chile is the country where there has been a prime battleground between outright fascism under the dictatorship of Pinochet,
right,
and social democracy, democratic processes under people like Eduardo Frei and Michelle Bachelet and so on. So the new Spanish Prime Minister has started his tour there, and he'll go also to Peru, Colombia, and Costa Rica. So he'll be calling in on Colombia, right, to check out, you know, how best to coordinate with the new Colombian president, whatever the EU, the European Union, and in particular Spain's foreign policy should be in relation to the region, in tandem with whatever the United States is cooking up.
Right.
And I just find it interesting also that the new Spanish Prime Minister will not be visiting Nicaragua, he'll be visiting Costa Rica.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it?
So, you know, looking at the region as a whole, and you have also the current situation in Ecuador, where Ecuador, as we predicted many months ago, you and I, Don, both predicted that Ecuador would leave ALBA.
Mm-hmm.
Leave the ALBA block of countries, and it has done so kind of pretty much on schedule, as we thought.
Yeah.
And there's nothing surprising about that, but it's still very depressing in terms of the ability of the progressive agenda to hold its ground against this relentless assault from United States-backed right-wing policies across the region in Argentina, Paraguay, Peru, Colombia. And let's see what happens in Mexico.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
I'm not entirely optimistic about what Andres Manuel López Obrador will be able to do, given the current context and all the limitations that he's faced with. And you can see that in the current President Peña Nieto is desperately trying to do is to stitch up a resolution of Mexico's disputes over the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has been a thorn in the side of the Mexican and U.S. relations over the last year, well, pretty much ever since President Donald Trump took office. Right. And it looks as though Trump is going to get a win there in terms of stitching up Mexico's economy in favor of the United States' interests within the NAFTA framework.
Yeah.
Before Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador takes office.
You know, it's interesting, that whole situation as well. Because I've seen how some of the contradictions that have been demonstrated over the last year and a half in this administration, they haven't resolved yet, but how they've tended towards the way they appear to be tending in Korea, for example. And also, there's some indications of that being true with Iran as well, with all of the thunder about, first during the campaign, about the agreement that was reached with Iran, the JCPOA agreement, where Trump ran against it, you know, aggressively against that, and then canceled it almost immediately to the extent that there was anything to cancel, because really the sanctions had not been lifted in any meaningful way. And so just the rainbow effects on other countries had, which meant something to Iran, but not to U.S. companies. Now suddenly they're actually behind the scenes talking. And, you know, there were some statements back and forth about having talks with no preconditions. With Mexico, again, he ran against NAFTA, and you have both, you know, this most recent election's outcome, first of all, and secondly, the contradictions nested within NAFTA, which are, even though American jobs, quote-unquote, as Trump put it, you know, get shipped over the border into Mexico, a lot of jobs in Mexico got shifted over here, only before it used to be a farmer job in Mexico, and here it's a laborer on some corporate farm under conditions of illegal, you got to look over your shoulder for ICE or the La Migra to come after you while you're getting paid minimum wage. In other words, the agricultural sector being destroyed in the independent agricultural sector being destroyed in Mexico by NAFTA and turning loose essentially people who were, you know, subsistence or even, you know, doing fairly well as small farmers, having to sneak across the border for some work, picking oranges or whatever, because that's all that's available to them. Undoing that really is not doing harm to Mexico's economy, and the president of Mexico can't be faulted for trying to pursue that.
No, and I think Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador understands very well that reality, because that's one of the reasons why the United States is seeking regime change here in Nicaragua. Right. Because one of the reasons that Nicaragua is a bad example for the rest of the region is that it's defended its small producer sector, its micro producer sector, its cooperative producer sector. They produce here in Nicaragua, we're one of the few countries anywhere in the world, but certainly in Latin America, that produce between 80 and 90% of our own food. So, and that's no good for the United States agribusiness corporations.
Right.
So, and that's, but also that's another a reason why. If you look at the whole issue of climate justice, why has Nicaragua been one of the countries that has tried to stand firm against the Paris Agreement, eventually ended up signing it, but it stood out against the Paris Agreement for a long time because it insisted on the issue of climate justice,
right,
and that the rich countries that are responsible for climate change.
Right.
And why does President Trump and why do the U.S. corporate elites deny climate change? Because it means that they'd have to cough up money under any climate justice framework,
right,
to recompense vulnerable countries like Nicaragua or Mexico, for example, in particular Mexico,
yep,
which is the kind of birthplace of maize, which is, you know, just absolutely fundamental to the Mesoamerican social economy and popular economy.
Yep.
And that whole issue of climate justice is another reason, and it's so ironic that liberals in the United States are so blind to all this.
I know.
And climate justice is another reason why the United States wants regime change here in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
It's why they hate Lula. It's why they hate Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. It's why they hate Andres Manuel López Obrador, although he won the Mexican election. Much to my surprise, I thought he'd either have it rigged against him or end up being assassinated.
That might still happen.
So, but all that stuff is why the U.S. corporate elites are targeting these leaders and why they're targeting vulnerable countries like Nicaragua for regime change and trying to dress it up. Oh, and Venezuela, of course, and Cuba.
Right.
And, you know, the next one on the list is going to be Bolivia, of course. So, you know, and that's, I think people of progressive and liberal opinion in the United States really need to look hard at the absolute presuppositions from which they're departing.
Right. I agree. You know, let's go right to the darling of these folks, the Paris Agreement itself. You know, one of the things that gets me is just about every one of them that wants to have a conversation about climate change starts out with anyone who's opposed to the Paris Agreement is anti-scientific. And then you ask them if they actually have read the Paris Agreement, which would be where someone with scientific orientation would begin a conversation, looking at the actual documents that are the subject matter of the conversation. And most of them haven't. They don't understand that what you have essentially is a regime of climate imperialism, not a regime of defense against things that are damaging the environment and causing climate change. And those are two very distinct, you know, things. One means you're going to solve the problem you're complaining about. The other is how you're going to allocate the burdens of the problem that you're now a party to creating.
Right. I very much agree with that, Don. But for me, the fundamental thing is how opinion in North America and Western Europe seems oblivious to the absolutely clear link between that kind of very fundamental issue for humanity and fundamental issues like peace.
Right.
You know, and nuclear disarmament and stuff like that.
And nuclear war. We got
to
stop there.
Why are they so blind to the links between these fundamental issues the attacks on progressive political leaders in Latin America?
That's right. We are completely out of time, so we got to stop here, Tony. Thank you very much, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks a million, Don. Look forward to seeing you talking to you next week.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. Hiroshima suffered the horrific consequence of a nuclear blast, and now it aims to lead a global struggle to abolish the nuclear weapons altogether. Will it succeed? Well, I talked to Hidehiko Yuzaki, governor of Japan's Hiroshima Prefecture.
73 years after the world first saw the devastating effects of nuclear weapons, the globe's nuclear arsenal is growing, with thousands of warheads armed and ready to wipe civilization off the planet. Can humanity afford to rely on fear of mutually assured destruction to keep peace? Is the drive to ban and get rid of nuclear weapons realistic? And are the lessons of Hiroshima remembered well enough today?
Governor Yuzaki, really great to have you on our program. Welcome to Russia.
Thank you very much.
So, lots of relevant issues to discuss with you. So far, your country is the only country that has suffered from the use of the nuclear weapons, so it is understandable why Japanese people are so adamant on abolishing nuclear arms. But you say that those advocating nuclear disarmament are realistic. You really think so? I mean, how realistic? Because nuclear states, including your biggest partner, United States, oppose that.
Well, I say, realistic, because our argument or, the goal for abolishment of nuclear weapons is based on the reality of what happens to human beings when it's used, when it's actually used. So we know the reality of the use of it. And sometimes deterrence or strategy. They're all discussed on paper. You know, there are certain assumptions. There are certain assumptions. If this number, if we have this number, you know, it's enough to deter certain actions, etc. Well, there are, you know, others too. You know, mostly it's perception, idea-based, but not standing on the real outcome.
Are you talking about those who are actually supporters of the deterrence?
Yeah.
But, I mean, we didn't have a war mm-hmm. for the last 70 years, yes. thanks to deterrence. You don't think that's reason enough to think that that's a good thing?
Yeah, well, deterrence, or not having a war, or not having a large number of casualty, is not necessarily just because U.S. and Russia or, you know, other country has had nuclear weapons. There are so many other factors that had deterred the war. And, well, I'm talking about this, you know, nuclear deterrence. And deterrence is something that's probably necessary. But I'm talking about nuclear deterrence. What is the added value of nuclear deterrence, you know, to the conventional deterrence and other deterrence?
So probably the fact that it should never, ever take place because it's so horrid that no one would ever want to have that ever happen again.
But that is based on the assumption that there is no mistake, there is no misjudgment, there is no accident. You know, there are a lot of assumptions that the current you know, deterrence is based on. And historically, actually, it's been proven wrong. You know, there has been many accidents, many misjudgments that had almost led to the actual nuclear war, which is a really risky situation.
So these nuclear powers, that the global powers, at this point, they're all very wary of each other. That's why they don't really want to give up their nukes. How do you see this technically happening if it were ever to happen? Like, they all should give it up at the same time?
Well, of course, the process needs to be carefully designed, and I don't think it's going to happen like that or overnight. What we need now is to seriously look into, and of course, the situation is very different in regions. Deterrence against what? You know, what are we deterring against? In where? Is a very important question, and we have to dig into those details and try to come up with the process in each situation to reduce the nuclear weapons and finally eliminate them.
You've said it yourself, each region is different, they all have their reasons, and nuclear weapons are only a manifestation of global political problems that each country has, right? Can you realistically get rid of the nuclear weapons without addressing those problems? Because, you know, they're intertwined together. I mean, Pakistan is afraid of a bigger India. Kim Jong-un doesn't want to be the next Saddam Hussein. Israel is surrounded by hostile Arab states. So unless you address those political problems, you can't really talk about getting rid of nukes.
Well, no, I don't think so. First, again, you know, deterrence is nuclear deterrence is different from deterrence. So we are talking about nuclear deterrence and the added value of nuclear deterrence. And if you carefully look into each situation, we should be able to find the new equilibrium. Strategic stability is equilibrium in game theory. And there is a multiple, possible multiple equilibrium, usually. And that's based on conditions or assumptions. And if we could find the way to move that, you know, equilibrium to other position, which is less costly, or namely, you know, without equilibrium, without nuclear weapon, that's much more economical, probably, and less risk. So what I'm saying is, why not we just say, oh, because we have this conflict, having nuclear weapon is something that is taken as granted. But let's look for ways, whether, you know, the ways to move this equilibrium to a new one, you know. And of course, I don't say it's easy. there are some measures, probably, that multiple party needs to agree upon. But I don't think it's impossible. We just have to make that effort now.
What do you think of the nuclear weapons ban treaty adopted by the United Nations? Can it ever go beyond declaring intent and actually have an actual impact?
But it's true that the nuclear weapon countries must be involved in the process. Otherwise, I mean, it's only the nuclear weapon countries that can reduce or eliminate nuclear weapons. So they have to be involved. And it's, you know, about the process again, you know, how we involve the nuclear weapon states.
So you have this ambitious Hiroshima for Global Peace plan in motion. And I've looked at it, and I have to say that I admire the idea of it. I admire your devotion to it. I do have my doubts about how to promote what you stand for. I mean, conferences and rock concerts, you know, I cover politics a lot and wars a lot, and, you know, peace doesn't come through concerts and conferences. So how do you make sure that you impact through this program?
Yeah, well, you should be aware that sometimes peace comes through music concerts, too.
That I agree.
Yeah. So, you know, those activities, you know, there are some activities that are targeted at public, you know, like increasing public awareness, or some activities are targeted at more experts, you know, like roundtable talk that we have in Hiroshima. This is a talk among experts and ex-policy makers about what we can do. So, you know, we think the final goal, of course, is to eliminate nuclear weapons. But who eliminates it is actually the leader of the nuclear weapon country and the structure that supports the leader, like the bureaucracy and expert system, and also public, which has the basic foundation for those systems, right? So we are trying to find the ways to, you know, reach out in each, in how, you know, how effective each action is, etc. We have to try many things because, you know, this is very complicated and very significant issue. So it doesn't happen at one day again, you know. So we're trying to do as much, whatever we can, and find a more effective way to achieve our goal.
We're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Governor Yuzaki. We'll discuss more who is right, those behind the deterrence policy or those who want denuclearization. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Governor Yuzaki. Governor, so there are some serious steps towards nuclear abolition going on in your neighboring North Korea. I wonder what you think about that, because it has announced a suspension of nuclear and missile ballistic tests and shutting down a nuclear test site. This is widely seen as a positive step towards nuclearization. Do you think Kim Jong-un is actually not going to make any nuclear tests anymore?
Well, we cannot have a conclusion yet. We have to see. We have to see their actual actions. We've been betrayed so many times through the past negotiations with North Korea. So what's important is the actual actions. And it's been said, one of the word is that used is irreversible. And how it is irreversible and how to prove it and, check it is a very important issue. But we need to do that to actually believe that North Korea is denuclearizing.
So you have North and the South Koreas that are meeting right now, and the talks between America and North Korea are being set up. And all of those partners, South Korea, North Korea, South Korea, America, Japan, they're saying that the ultimate goal is to see completely denuclearized North Korea. But like a logical question is, why would Kim Jong-un give up his nuclear arsenal? I mean, why all of a sudden destroy completely something that he's building up for a decade?
Yeah, well, that is exactly why we have to really see the actions of North Korea. I think, Kim Jong-un's motivation is, of course, one, extending the current regime. And if he believes having a nuclear weapon is more beneficial to extending the regime, he may hold on to it. And if he believes giving it up is more beneficial for extending the regime, I think he will. So, we have to prepare an environment that he believes, and this is beneficial for him.
Can you be more precise? In your opinion, what should he be getting in exchange of giving up the nukes?
Well, what he's saying is a security assurance and denuclearization. And, there might be, with this security assurance, there might be a more concrete requests or requirements or conditions, like having no U.S. force in the peninsula or something. So I don't know. They will come out. It's very difficult to predict now, what conditions he will give up the nuclear weapons at this point. We need to see.
And also, the timing. I want to discuss the timing, because Japan's foreign minister says that North Korea should abolish nuclear arms by 2020. Do you think that's a realistic goal, time-wise? Because, it took 2 years of talks to just stop the Iranian nuclear program. They didn't even have an actual weapon. How can this diplomacy with North Korea work faster than with Iran?
Well, whether it's realistic or too fast or too slow, I hope if it happens by 2020, that's very welcome. And to the extent that is possible, everyone should make every effort to achieve that. I would say there is not too early for that, right? So I don't know if it's achievable or not, but at least we could try.
So like I've mentioned, South Korea, America are going to sit down and talk to North Korea. Mm-hmm. As of now, Japan hasn't been invited to those talks. Do you think it should be part of those talks, and what can it bring to the table?
Well, Japan has a lot of roles in the kind of entire or having or setting the entire condition, or setting the entire environment, or in the longer process of post agreement too. And I don't know at this point what Japan can do, but at least carefully see U.S. and Korea's movement or actions. And I think, again, I'm not in a government position, but we should not relieve the pressure on North Korea unless we actually see the output or outcome or actions.
It's also quite interesting to see what's going to happen to your country's security, because Japan has been relying on U.S. for protection for decades, and now Trump is saying its allies in Asia Pacific should rely more and more on their own resources, their own security. And then, we've recently heard the Japanese government saying that slowly Japan should be expanding its own Japanese military. Do you think it's time to rethink the security concept of Japan?
Well, I don't think the big picture will change. We'll continue the alliance with the United States. And, of course, we'll have close relationship with Korea and other some of the other Southeastern Asian countries, too. But in that balance, or some roles could be redefined. Well, for example, we as Hiroshima, would like to see Japan to be out of U.S. nuclear deterrence. Not the deterrence as a whole, but U.S. nuclear deterrence. That will give us a better position in terms of promoting the nuclear elimination or nuclear disarmament. And for example, if you look carefully, We recently received a report, a paper from UNIDIR, UN's research institute. If you goes back to the first question, but if we look carefully at the situation, nuclear deterrence against North Korea is not necessary,
But American, but American nuclear deterrence, in a way, is a guarantee that no one attacks Japan as well. No.
Well, no, not necessarily, because for example, North Korea, their motivation is to not to be invaded, not to be attacked to destroy their regime.
I'm sorry I keep interrupting you, but yeah. I'll forget to ask you this. It feels like you don't think that North Korea is actually capable of attacking a neighbor.
Yeah, well, they are. They are capable of attacking a neighbor, but whether they will do is a different question. Right?
So you don't think they'll do. They think they use the nukes just to keep the regime in place. That's it.
Yeah, well, unless they feel, really oppressed or... they feel there's immediate, very imminent danger of being attacked. But they know that once they use the nuclear weapons, that's basically the end of their regime. Because there'll be fought back. And, there's so much unbalance between...
So you don't feel like... I just have to go to the question because you didn't quite answer. You don't feel like you need American nuclear deterrence because you don't feel like North Korea is actually about to attack someone. It's more about keeping its regime intact.
Well, it's not about feeling or, it's not about feeling. And it's not me saying this, but I'm talking about this UNIDIR paper. And from North Korea's point of view, their nuclear deterrence. You know, what they are deterring against is attack from outside to destroy their regime. And if they attack first, you know, it's very certain that their regime will collapse. So is there a real possibility, or is there a high probability that North Korea is going to attack, you know, from themselves? Well, yeah, what we're talking about at this point, right? And if U.S., I'm again talking about this paper, is to destroy the North Korea's nuclear capability, you know, they need to use so many nuclear weapons, if they used nuclear weapons. And that is very unrealistic, because it's going to cause so much radiation issues, not only with North Korea, but South Korea, China, and Russia too. They're all affected, and of course Japan. And
the original question was that Japan always enjoyed America's protection because you don't have your own military security system in place to protect your country. Now that Trump is saying that you should rely more on your own resources, do you think Japan needs an actual army, an actual security system in place?
Yeah. Well, I don't say we don't have at all, right? We have conventional defense system to a certain extent, and we're partnering with the United States. My view is, for example, you know, this nuclear deterrence against North Korea, we may have an argument that we could be get out of the nuclear deterrence, and that's a change of the roles and the balance, right? So there could be a new balance and, you know, new rethinking of our security system.
I just have last two questions. Sensitive issue, yeah. Chinese perception of Japan in general.
Yeah.
So the American president has visited Hiroshima, but do you see a situation where a Japanese prime minister, for instance, visits Nanjing? Because the Chinese are saying, you know, this whole anti-nuclear campaign in Japan, of which you are part of course, is sort of a way to whitewash Japan's role in World War II. And it's not fair because you can't discuss the bombing without the reasons behind the bombing. Do you see a situation where your prime minister would actually visit Nanjing, like American president visited Hiroshima?
Yeah, well, that may be possible, you know. And, of course, that depends on the environment and the context. If that is in the core of the context, I think it would be difficult for our prime minister to go. But that part is out of the context. You know, he may be able to go.
All right. Gardner, thank you very much for this interview. Wish you all the best of luck. Yeah. Have a nice rest of the day in Russia.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.